I don't want mid-budget franchise or intellectual properties, though. Don't do it to me, Lily.
Welcome to Groovy Movies. My name is Lily Austin.
And my name is James Brailsford. Hello.
Hello. How are you, James?
Yes, not too bad at all. Just, getting my head around what's happening out there in the world of film, actually. Just, that's just how I live. What can I say? I wake up, think about a film, go through the day thinking about film, go to bed thinking about film. This is my life. And then the one respite to get from thinking about it is talking about it with you.
Yeah. Okay, that was great. A beautiful segue into film news from this week. Shall we discuss Quentin Tarantino? He's been back in the news.
Yes, absolutely. It's very interesting that these events have transpired. It's something I've been pondering for about the past year, like what's happening with Tarantino's last film. So it's an interesting, if not for me, entirely surprising turn of events.
Well, just remind the listeners, what's going on with this movie? Why is it a significant film?
Sure. So for Quentin Tarantino, for at least the last decade or so, has been publicly making it very clear that he wants to do 10 films and then get out, because he's been looking back at the careers of the masters. And I mean, the obvious one to point out is Alfred Hitchcock. And he says that in the last decade or so, the last few films of their career, there's a big drop off in quality. And he doesn't want to be one of those directors. He's very much thinking about his oeuvre and his thing that he's leaving off. So it's a big deal. It's 10 and done, game over, that's it. So he's been talking a big talk. And so Once Upon a Time in Hollywood was his 9th film. So the next film is the last one, basically.
And he had planned, he announced, right, at the press conference for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, that this film was going to be called The Film Critic. And I think more recently, Brad Pitt was said to be attached. And there was lots of rumors about who was going to be in it. Apparently Olivia Wilde had a meeting to perhaps play Pauline Kael, was the rumor, who's this very well-known 70s film critic. Who I love. I think that would have been fun. But it's all over.
Well, yeah. I mean, so here's my pondering. I've been pondering about Tarantino's 10th film since before there was any announcement of a kind of 10th film happening. Because I was curious as to what was happening here when Tarantino announced his next project would be in 2023. He'd be directing an 8-part TV series. And that immediately... that had my antennae twitching, because I thought, here we have one of the proponents of the cinematic experience of shooting on film, of the cinematic experience about going into theatres. Here's like one of the prime advocates of that. You know, you listen to any interview he has, it will touch upon this topic to some degree almost every interview he does. So for suddenly someone who's that passionate about the film experience to be making an 8-part limited TV series, just felt like, oh, right, okay, the tectonic plates have shifted this much that we're here. So that was my initial thought. And I thought, okay, so he's going to concentrate on this TV series before his 10th film. Again, I just thought, if this is an artist with such a laser focus on his oeuvre, this 8-part TV series seems like a big distraction. It doesn't seem like that was ever part of his plan. So these are all just things that just slightly concerned me for him as a filmmaker, just as a filmmaker.
And did that show come out? What was the show?
It's just completely gone quiet. It hasn't been cancelled or dropped, but he was meant to be shooting in 23 and he hasn't shot anything in 23.
Oh.
So what I'm trying to say is, what I think happened is like he was walking home one day. I know he doesn't live in America. This is a fantasy walking home concept. He was walking home one day, saw a little advert saying free 35mm film screenings. He went inside and the doors closed behind him and out pops Christopher Nolan. And behind Christopher Nolan is Paul Thomas Anderson with a baseball bat. Guarding the outdoors is Tacita Dean. And they're like, listen, Quentin, right? We know the theatrical industry is on its knees. The cinematic experience is on its knees. Now, Thomas Anderson isn't saying anything. He's just playing with the baseball bat. And he's just saying, you are not helping the problem by working for a streamer if you're worried about the death of the cinematic experience. What we need, Quentin, is auteur filmmakers who still got clout making things in the cinema. And he's like, yes, of course, right? Tacita Dean's outside the front. Because if anyone thinks there's some funny business going on behind a door with a little hastily made cinema that says three 35mm screenings, someone comes up and it's Tacita Dean going, oh, don't worry, they're just installing the projector.
I'm sorry, my latest Tacita analog Dean? Film business.
Ooh, oh, Lily.
I know, but maybe our listeners don't. I'm asking for the listeners.
No, fair enough.
No, I don't know.
She's like...
Tacita's a woman?
She's a visual artist specializing in art made on photochemical film. So her and Christopher Nolan, they often like do talks together because her entire art practice would not exist if they weren't Hollywood filmmakers giving Kodak enough money to keep the company going over. So she has access to her art materials. So anyway, all I'm saying is she'd be part of that gang putting the pressure on Quentin.
Can I just say that this would make a great SNL sketch? I can see it now. Right. I love it. I'm obsessed. Okay, I love that. I hope that's what happened. My other wonder would be because now the money has dropped out of streaming services and they've all changed tack and they're not now giving that kind of crazy money to big name directors to make movies on their platforms anymore. They're just going for the generic, you know, demographic focused middle of the road content. So they also, you know, he might have waited too long. Tarantino might not be getting an offer right now from Netflix anymore.
You could be quite right, Lily. Yeah, I mean, that's perfectly, I think, the way the industry's run out. Although I would say probably any streamer's probably going to be quite happy to have a Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah.
Probably. But
probably. I mean, his last movie, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, was his second biggest movie after Django Unchained. So he's, even though he's worried about dropping off, I mean, his whole thing, right, was like, I'm going to finish at 60. He's now 61 and he was 10 movies by 60. He's fucked that up. He's taking too long. So...
I think in his quest to have the perfect 10, maybe as well, I think there's a psychological pressure that he fucked himself there by saying, I'm going to do 10 and done, and I'm going to go out on a good one. Because the psychological pressure of being an artist who's had a lot of successes to then say, right, well, this better be the film that's worth rounding out my 10.
Like, yeah, I mean, it's very smart marketing and, like, you know, excitement building, anticipation building. If I knew, I'm not a Tarantino fan now. I don't really like the way his movies have evolved. I was much more into his early work, but such an awful saying that. I prefer early Tarantino, but I would definitely watch his 10th movie.
I really quite like his later period.
Do you?
That's a wanky thing to say. Found myself growing into his later period.
In fairness, I did actually enjoy Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I thought that was quite good. I hated Django Unchained for many reasons. But anyway, all that is to say is that if you put this idea out there, this is my 10th movie, everyone's going to want to see that final film. But the pressure for that to be your best movie when you know you've not got another one in you, you're saying no more. It's intense. And I think the movie critic sounded to me, obviously I like movies. I would love to watch a movie about movie critic. I don't know about Brad Pitt. I feel like I'm kind of done with seeing him, but whatever. I'd love a movie about Pauline Kael. That would be awesome. Tarantino movie about Pauline Kael. And she's like, has to save cinema from the streamers or something. She goes to the future. Oh my God, it's all coming to me now. Okay, I'm not going to say anymore. I don't want anyone to steal my idea. But I don't know if it's a final film. It doesn't sound to me, I'm sure he would have made an amazing film, but it doesn't, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood actually would be a logical final film, you know?
Yeah, it almost feels like the critic almost feels like a bit of a coda. It doesn't feel, it almost feels like a, you know, he'd do a 10th film and then the film critic could be his cheeky 11th film, but he's not going to refer it to one of the main canon, you know, anything like that. But I think the bigger point I was trying to get to is that I think that he announced the movie critic under the worst possible reasons for announcing it, which I think he got a bit worried that the industry that supports his films wouldn't be there in a few years' time. And I think he announced the movie critic kind of under the gun. And I get the feeling that some way into this process he's realized that under the threat of the extinction of his industry, slash under the threat of it being his last ever film out of the 10. I just think that's an enormous amount. They're all the wrong reasons to be rushing into a production, you know.
Yeah.
I don't get any impression that he's like, this is the film, I'm here, I'm ready. I feel like, yeah, it's all a bit under the gun.
Yes. Well, it's a shame. I was looking forward to seeing that movie, but it remains to be seen what his 10th movie will be. We'll keep an eye out for it, listeners.
Will it become The Critic, the TV series? Is that what it's going to be made of, the 8-part TV series, perhaps, which would be a shame?
I don't think there's 8 parts in a film. Honestly, I think a film critic is movie and an hour and a half and done.
Although I quite like the idea of Pauline Kael as some like time cop, and she goes into the future and the past and she corrects.
Let's write the screenplay. Don't tell them.
I'd watch like 10 seasons of that. It'd be awesome.
It would be amazing. It could start with one of her reviews, you know. That could be the framework for each episode. It's a different review. Oh my God. It's all coming to me. Okay, we'll talk about it off air.
You heard it here first, listeners.
Other film news this week. I don't know how you feel about it, James. I feel like you've been slightly proven right, because Civil War has been knocked to 5th place worldwide, 4 in both UK, Ireland, and the US. So, it's crawling towards making a profit.
It's crawling.
It's on 86 mil right now. We think it needs to make about 100 mil to break even. So, fingers crossed.
To break even. Remember, that's not making a profit. It's like, once we get to 100 mil, then we can start popping the party poppers. Woo! We made $10 profit.
I think we can do it. I mean, yeah, the goodwill around A24 is that, I think, just that marketing campaign, just like, it's too conflicting. Like, it's too unaligned, you know?
Yeah, it was just wrong time. I don't think the appetite for this kind of film wasn't there. And maybe time will be more, you know, maybe in history we'll look back at this film as something pivotal, but right now it's just not landed, you know.
Yeah. And number one over the weekend was a movie called The Roundup, Punishment, a South Korean movie about, I believe it's about detectives undercovering an online gambling ring and taking them down. Not been released in the West. We'll be interested to see if that does get released over here. I suspect maybe not, but I hope so. I'd be up for seeing it. It sounds kind of fun.
Yeah, it does sound very fun, and it's clearly very popular in its home market. I mean, for the fact that on the worldwide box office, our number one is not a Western American film. Which
not even released in either of these places. Just shows the power of everywhere but the West.
I think it's showing shifting tastes. There's way more to potentially for me to research before I give any definitive, but, you know, it could be also reflecting just generally audiences in the West, just cinema going isn't as big a part of the cultural experience, and perhaps film going is a bit more of a cultural experience. So it's just a bit thing that more people see more often. And what's happening is the average level of most American and Western blockbusters is just diminishing, so that a well-performing, non-Western released film can punch suddenly onto the top of the worldwide box office. And of course, I mean, I'm sure this doesn't make a huge difference, but it will make a difference, which I know that, like, China has a ton of IMAX theaters, which means they're premium theaters, which means if you go to see a film there, then you are paying more, which helps get box office up with fewer seats. So that's contributing factor, but I'm sure I'm not going to say that that's the only reason, but I think all these things, that's why we're seeing such impressive box office numbers from China, I think, because they have a lot of screens and they have a lot of slightly premium screens.
Okay, well, number two is Challengers, Luca Guadagnino's new movie that is number one in the US and UK and Ireland. We're going to talk about that on our next episode. So you've got a whole 2 weeks, listeners, to watch the movie and get up to speed before we discuss. I felt it was very important that we talk about it in healthy competition with Wimbledon, the most important tennis movie of the last 40 years, I would say.
Okay.
It's gonna be good, guys. It's gonna be good. But yeah, I'm very happy to see it hit the top spot. I mean, after it being pushed back last year because of the strikes, the release date got pushed back because Zendaya wouldn't have been able to do the kind of press circuit, and she is obviously the pull for this movie.
Need Zendaya on that press circuit.
You absolutely do. Yeah, it's good to see it doing so well. It's definitely, I think it is by far Luca Guadagnino's biggest film. And yeah, I'm excited to talk about it. So stay tuned for that, guys.
Absolutely.
But that is in 2 weeks' time. For today, we are talking about two films that I think it's, you wouldn't on the surface maybe put together, but stay with us and we'll explain all. We're talking about The Zone of Interest and Perfect Days.
Possibly the most opposite end of the spectrum double bill you could hope to have.
Yeah. And I need to hasten to warn you guys that I did have a little bit of a technical issue with my mic on this. So it's a little bit crispy at the beginning, but stay with us and it does get better, I promise.
The dog ate my homework.
Yeah. So enjoy, guys.
Well, tell me about your experience watching these films.
Well, I saw The Zone of Interest and Perfect Days in the same week, actually. And they both made a very deep impression. I was really struck by actually how much they had in common, because both films tell stories through showing the minutiae of day-to-day life and through the mundanity of the domestic. And both do so in such a naturalistic way. You know, it's almost like documentary style.
Yeah.
So what struck me about that was just how those similarities were in service of almost antithetical sides of humanity. You know, The Zone of Interest examines the human capacity for cruelty, and Perfect Days looks at the capacity for love, I think, and the appreciation of all that is good.
Two very different kind of feelings you get at the end of the film, aren't they? Absolutely, they're pretty much the polar opposites.
Yeah, completely. But then both using mundanity to explore very, very different aspects of humanity.
Talking about mundanity, because I mean, I think with Perfect Day, for example, part of what we might call the mundanity is the ritualistic nature, the kind of repetitive nature, the fact that we see the same things happening over and over again because his day is highly ritualized. And similarly, in Zone of Interest, what we see characters kind of going through very ordinary day-to-day things might not be quite as much repetition, but there's a kind of just a routine to everything that's happening.
Yeah, exactly. I think examining these things through the use of routine, like seeing the routine of their lives, is really powerful.
The use of routine is interesting, isn't it? Because routine is definitely not what happens in pretty much every single film story you will ever see, be it an interpersonal drama or a big action film. It's very much about the disruption of the routine. It's usually about trying to reestablish the routine of a story or trying to get to routine. But what we never see in most stories is just the routine. That doesn't really fit in a three-act structure.
Yeah, absolutely. You're completely right. Usually films are about something unusual happening. You know, we don't see people brushing their teeth every day and going to work and cleaning toilets, as we'll discuss in Perfect Days. It's like, I find that incredibly, I don't want to say brave, I feel like that word is a bit overused, but something in that sphere, you know, to know that you can tell a story with these sorts of things when usually it's considered like this won't be engaging. But actually, I think in these instances, it's exactly that that makes the kind of message that is coming through with that really, really powerful.
What's happening here? We're kind of working against one of the very foundations of what we would call Western cinema, which is the plot. You know, the plot has a start, middle, and end. Our characters have obstacles reaching the plot. And in both of these films, I would say with Zone of Interest, I'd be even loath to call it a plot, but there's the slightest bit of, you might call it interpersonal drama for the Hoss family there. But it's routine. It's very mundane. It's nothing exciting. It doesn't energize the plot. I mean, this is either a non-plot or an anti-plot. I can never remember from my film school lectures which one means which. But basically, neither of them are very strong on the plot.
Yeah. Well, let's get into it, The Zone of Interest, because we can talk about this a little bit more. Mm. So it came out at the start of the year. Jonathan Glazer's movie about the Holocaust, you can say, even though the film very deliberately doesn't depict those crimes. It follows the Hoss family. Christian Friedel plays Rudolf Hoss, who is the commandant of Auschwitz. And Sandra Hüller plays Hedwig Hoss, his wife. So we follow them in the family home that is just outside Auschwitz gates.
And of course, the film is set entirely from the perspective of the family. So we never venture over the wall. We only ever hear things or see the smoke of trains arriving or of what we assume to be crematoriums expunging kind of their ashes. So even though these things aren't shown, you can't help but be constantly thinking about it and reflecting on these things throughout the entirety of the film.
I found it amazing because there is very, very little that you see. Yeah, you see the tower outside of their garden wall. And we understand what that means. At least anyone who knows about this, a lot of people understand. But what I found interesting was the fact that Jonathan Glazer, the director, completely trusts the audience to understand what is being signified with so little. You know, nothing is ever verbally explained. We're seeing it as if we are there with them and already understand everything. It's all just implied, but he trusts that we understand that.
I think the thing that struck me with this film almost immediately is offering a perspective that I've never seen before in a film, this non-judgmental observation of the Hoss family who are right next door to Auschwitz. They are perpetrators of the highest order of what was happening in Nazi Germany. It was excruciating in a very interesting way that the way it's filmed, but it was to use this kind of feel of a documentary to feel that the language of cinema is being stripped away. So maybe in some other films, you might have dramatic close-ups or cameras moving and following and swerving. Here, the camera is mostly static and just observing at a distance. We very rarely move in or cut in. The camera, when it moves, is often just moving sideways very simply to follow the actors. But that feeling of just being there is quite fascinating. I went to see it at a very big cinema. The image is sharp and clear, and it's almost unrelenting in how unvarnished it feels, that there's no hiding behind any veneer, that this is what it would have been like if you were there.
Completely. You're just observing people going about their day-to-day lives. And I had an interview with Christian Friedel, and he said that Jonathan Glazer advised that he said that if you speak the truth, then lie with your eyes. And if your eyes tell the truth, then lie with your mouth, as kind of something to keep in mind while he was playing the part. But I thought that's kind of what the film is doing the whole way through, is that you're seeing the kind of truth of their day-to-day life. And you know that it's like, you know, underneath that, what seems like an innocent, you know, they're going for a picnic, their children are playing together, Hedwig is taking her baby around the flower patch. And then the whole time, you know that under this idyllic scene is this just, you know, incredible, incredible darkness and evil, basically. I just find that so powerful.
I mean, it's a very experiential film, which is my kind of film. You know, I'm all about the cinematic experience, and this was a cinematic experience. There's no other way to describe it. The way that you are made to feel, the sensations you get, the thoughts that are put into your head, and yet no character says out loud the things that you're thinking. It's the juxtaposition of thoughts that you're seeing and hearing. Here you are looking at the very mundanity of day-to-day life, but you are fully aware of how deeply entrenched you are in the Nazi world. Mm-hmm. And you're having to realize that there is cognitive dissonance that all these characters exist in. You are placed in their perspective. And then occasionally their behavior just out of nowhere. I remember the moment with Hedwig Hoss saying to the Jewish girl who's like a housemaid about how my husband could spread your ashes all over a field. Just like I remember just feeling like that's worse. I've never felt as bad some character in a film having said something, more so than any kind of villainous character. It just really deeply kind of hits you that.
Yeah, completely, completely cold. That is one of the few moments of really acknowledging what's going on.
Yeah.
They both have there a couple of moments, because the only sparse bit of plot there is about Rudolf Hoss being transferred to another place. And he has meetings about building the gas chambers, and it's horrific to watch because it's a very matter-of-fact meeting. These are men complimenting each other on their craftsmanship, and there are other meetings where people are talking about in a very matter-of-fact way of the kind of the organization and the logistics of what they are doing, which to me is like so chilling because of that. Well, again, this kind of use of kind of matter-of-fact mundanity, I just like, it just really like brings home the fact that this is like human beings doing this to other human beings.
The standout, I thought, sequence in the film was Hedwig Hoss confronting Rudolf Hoss about the fact that she doesn't want to leave Auschwitz because the family have a great life here. It's the idyllic life that they dreamed of when they were teenagers, as she says. And so while this conversation is happening, you are just thinking, this is her idea, essentially, of heaven, of perfection.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and we're just watching this story play out. There's no music to take you out to this. There's no nothing. You're just watching this very domestic, everyday scene that a couple will probably have throughout their relationship's life, you know? That just horrific. Just the juxtaposition between what you're hearing and what you know is happening, that's filmmaking. That's the kind of thing that only good films can really do.
Yeah, completely, completely. And that was actually, so that was what Jonathan Glazer, that moment was what he hung the film on, because they had access to archives of, you know, documentation about the Hoss family. And one of the things that he was shown was the fact that this was something that a servant overheard her saying this. So this is like a fact. And so it was what he thought is the thing that speaks volumes. You're right. It's like, yeah, it's a really striking moment. I'd be interested to hear what you think about the, is it cinematography, that how the technique of putting the cat that they used to film the family?
Because yeah.
I was fascinated by the way they actually made the film.
It comes under the category of cinematography, but also directing, which for someone like Jonathan Glazer, that's kind of his thing. He's a very visual director, so he's very involved with all the technical implementation of it. Clearly, he's still playing in the arena of techniques he first played with in Under the Skin, the Scarlett Johansson sci-fi film, where he kitted out like a van with multiple cameras so that he could shoot continuously with Scarlett Johansson as she interacted sometimes with non-actors on the street, without them having to stop and reframe the camera. They just fitted the van up with multiple different cameras so they could cut in post-production to the different angles. And he took that approach and applied it to Zone of Interest. So he wanted it to feel, and he said that scenes would play out rather than do a scene like you would do with one camera, then you'd restage the scene multiple times and get the different close-ups and different shots. Rather than do that, which would add a layer of artifice, because there's a subliminal thing that we don't notice, but when we cut from a wide shot to a close-up that isn't happening at the exactly real time, part of us kind of knows that, you know, we're watching a film.
Yeah.
Whereas we're so used to watching Big Brother and live kind of things of seeing these still static wide cameras in housing cutting between different angles.
Yeah.
And that has a different feeling when you cut between the angles as things are really happening, that you're not restaging it. There's an element of, again, almost subliminally, that tells you that this is real. So each sequence in Zone of Interest was staged with multiple hidden cameras, because he said they wanted to take themselves out of it as well, the crew. They wanted the actors to be acting essentially in a 360-degree reality without being taken out of this world that they were in. So yeah. This multiple camera technique allowed them to have like an observational element to it. But also, I would like to say, it's definitely not a documentary, this film. You know, it plays with those conventions.
You don't feel like you're watching a documentary, but you're right, any sense of artifice or kind of classic screen techniques are just not there. You know, not that they didn't use any lighting, and
they did use lighting, but they only were allowed to use the exact kind of practical lighting that existed. So the artificial light they would have would be the 40 watt bulbs in the lampshades of light.
Sure, yeah. I don't count that as lighting.
Oh yeah, it's still light, and they would wait for specific times of the day to shoot certain scenes in certain parts of the house. So they would wait until it was dawn or dusk, so in a certain house the sun was in the right position. So again, all natural lighting, but very, very considered, you know.
Sure.
So the most you can manipulate the real world is what they did with their lighting.
And so and the cameras were set up, they were like hidden in parts of the rooms of the house.
Yeah, absolutely. So they were all hidden from each other. And I think it was a mixture of, they were literally disguising them, but then I think they would like paint out in post-production any bits where you might see them.
Right. So yeah, so when you're watching it, there's not this, like you said, like cuts, close-ups, that kind of thing. And also for the actors, if they're acting and not being aware that there's a camera there, that must be incredibly effective for getting into this role.
Well, yeah, I've not read anything with the actors of this film, but I know that Robert Altman, a director who was very kind of prolific in the 70s in American cinema, would often roll scenes with his actors with multiple cameras going and everyone's mic'd up and everyone's always on. And the actors would say that it completely changed your performance, because you never knew if you were essentially on, because you were always on. You could always be on one person's camera all the time for that scene. So it does affect how you modulate your performance. And I suspect something like that would have occurred here.
Yeah, that's what I watched an interview with Sandra Hüller, and she said something very akin to that, just about not there never being this moment where you're like, okay, the camera's off me now. I have, you know, even if it's just for a second, like a moment break, you know, you're just always completely in the character, in the role.
I knew roughly what to expect from this film going in, but then there were elements I wasn't anticipating. I kind of don't want to spoil it too much for people who watch film, but there's moments where suddenly the film looks like inverted, negative. A heat camera is what it actually is. That's a genuine heat camera. So it doesn't see light, it only sees heat. So that breaks up this documentary look. Suddenly I have a very clearly expressionistic image, you know, that kind of punctuates the film. And I love the sound design. The majority of the sound design, again, is very naturalistic. It's all almost monophonic. You know, it almost just comes from the screen. The surround channels, nothing, until those few moments where we go expressionistic with the visuals, you suddenly get surround. And it's like, it's quite pronounced. Then you go back to the reality, the mundanity, and the sound is just like stuck to the screen again. And again, that contrast, I really appreciated that in the cinema.
Something about that of being broken out of the minutiae of the day-to-day life and then having these moments of a break from that and then this music coming in. It's almost like giving you this pause to reflect on everything you've seen so far or something. It's like a chapter in it.
Well, part of me was thinking, because what we're seeing all the way through it, this mundanity, we're seeing this veneer that life is respectable and life is very nice for the hosts.
Exactly, yeah, you're right. It is such a veneer, a facade that they need to play out.
And then those moments when we go to this inverted image, suddenly it's like the dark heart of what's really going on is revealed. And in fact, the only time we see close to anything in the camps, it's all inverted. Like when we see the workers like spades all kind of stacked up in the round, we only ever see that inverted in this dark, like, you know, we're almost seeing the real soul of what's underneath the veneer.
Yeah. God, you're so clever. I hadn't even thought about that, but that's so true. That's so true. You
know, I went to film school, baby. I got a distinction in my master's.
I can't believe you've never mentioned that before. four series in and it comes out. Very good.
Thank you very much.
Okay, good. Well, should we move on to Perfect Days? I feel like it was there anything else you wanted to say about Zone of Interest?
I thought it was great. I really thought it was great. I avoid seeing it, as you well know. And
I know. I felt like I was bullying you every week. Have you seen Zone of Interest yet? Have you seen it?
My mood's been a bit on the lower side. And I just, you know.
It's not a film that you can put on any day of the week. You know, it's definitely not that kind of film.
And I went to see it in the morning, actually. I saw a 10 a.m. screening of it. And I thought that was a good time of the day
to see it.
Because you've got the rest of the day to kind of let it just noodle around and think about it. Whereas if you saw it at the end of the day and then you go to bed on that's pretty intense. Good for a morning viewing.
Yeah, that's how I did it the first time I saw it. And I did, I have to admit, I put on, I'm not really a comedy person, but I did put on like a sitcom before I went to sleep because I was like, oh, I can't. This is a very heavy thing to be going to sleep on. But it's so, so worth seeing, I think. There have been many really incredible films depicting the Holocaust, but this is definitely up there for a very different kind of way of exploring it that really does just make you think so much. I think, you know, like, I think it's so relevant to today, you know, I think you definitely come away from it questioning, like, certainly not feeling like this is, you know, pure evil and this will never happen again. It does really make you think like this is so important to keep sharing, telling these stories and remembering.
How many steps removed are most people from the hosses? You know, how exactly. Much of your day-to-day life could you see reflected there? Where did their lives diverge? Where did their moral compass diverge? And how did they ever know that was happening? All of these questions. I mean, this is what a good film does, just lots of questions floating around. And very much, you know, this is classic. It's a cinematic experience. I mean, a few people who've seen it have commented to me, they thought it was like an art film. And for them, that was like, they didn't enjoy it so much. And I totally get you. It's not a conventional film and it's different and it's difficult and it's challenging. But I thought it was a very, very good film and definitely one worth seeing at the cinema.
Definitely. Yeah. But on to, we can, what is my link to Perfect Days? It also uses mundanity, but
with a very, very different aim in mind.
My soul was sunny coming out of this film, where my soul was blackened and charred coming out of Zone of Interest. Yeah, very, very much different explorations of the kind of mundanity of life.
That is what struck me. So I'm like, gosh, like, it's incredible that the power of just looking at the day-to-day and the minutiae. Because, yep. do you want to do a little rundown of what Perfect Days is about, James?
God damn it, I can't escape, can I? You always ruin
Well,
me
you
into...
did. I did Zone of Interest.
Okay.
After much cajoling.
So yeah, Perfect Days, it's by a German director Wim Wenders, and it concerns a character called Hirayama, who is like a toilet cleaner. The film is about his day-to-day life, and it's like a cyclical film. So we keep seeing the same situations, or basically the same places that the character goes to each day. What happens, the characters he interacts with. It's clear he's a huge introvert. So, you know, it's quite nice to see an introvert portrayed on screen, someone who just prefers his own company in the main.
And it's very kind of, yeah, ritualistically shown, right? Because Hirayama, he every day wakes up and gets out of bed, brushes his teeth, gets a coffee on his way to the car, drives to work, goes to the toilets he's cleaning, and does that with his own kit. He's like very methodical. He takes absolute pride in his work, has the same lunch every day, finishes his day, goes to shower at kind of a public bath type thing.
Yeah.
And then goes to the same place for dinner every day. And then we see it again. I was so happy when we got to the weekend and we saw his weekend routine. That to me looked delightful. Doing his laundry. He's cycling around Tokyo where he lives, and he's just finished a book. Every night he reads a book for the week and then chooses another short book to start. It's just, it's like mindful cinema watching him in his day. And I just found it incredibly soothing and sort of almost cathartic to watch him do that and want so little and what he has to really enjoy and relish, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as I was watching this film, I was just watching it and I was just from a bit like I'm kind of looking at you, just from the side, it's like, what's this? What's the deal? What's going on here? I can just sniff I can sniff when something's up. But I was like,
was it the toilets? Were you wondering about the toilets? Because I was.
Completely separately. This wasn't actually some official research, but I was reading the monthly copy of American Cinematographer that I'm subscribed to. And there's an entire article all about the directing and cinematography of the film, and got to the bottom of it. And like, oh, that's the deal. Right. I'm now glad I know what the deal is with this film. So do you know the deal? Sounds like you know the deal.
I know the deal, but you can share the deal.
Okay, the deal. So the deal is that Wim Wenders was invited to Japan to check out an art and architectural project intended to reflect the country's dedication to the ideals of social cohesion and the common good. And it involved public toilets. And each restroom was designed and built by a renowned Japanese architect who normally works on large structures. And so Wim Wenders, they wanted him to make a documentary about the toilets. And he was like, don't really want to do a documentary, but, you know, maybe some short films about toilets, maybe we could do that. And so they said, yeah, sure. And so he penned a script with a Japanese writer. And 3 weeks later, they got a script. And then they returned to Tokyo. They shot the whole film in 17 days, which explains why it has this very loose documentary style. It's clearly all kind of run and gun, you know. In fact, it's almost in many ways the very opposite of Zone of Interest, which even though that did adopt some of the techniques of documentary, it had a very formal style. It had a very considered approach. You can tell that there's been like probably weeks, months, years of work and thought going into every sequence. Whereas in Perfect Day, it's much more improvisational, much more looser.
Yeah. And Koji Yakusho plays Hirayama, who is a really, really big actor in Japan, which I also thought was quite a nice element of it, because it just kind of adds a layer to the fact that this is a film about a man who cleans toilets every day and we're watching it, you know. It's just, I like how much specialness is brought to what seemingly is a very kind of, you know, minor life, you know. Like, if you explain what the film is about, it sounds quite dull and very insignificant, but so much importance is brought to it. The fact that that this actor was cast, the fact that it's filmed so cinematically. I mean, I had to Google these toilets because they're amazing. The toilets are incredible. and each one is different. They will have a very different design. And so I was struck by his jumpsuit, because every day he puts on this jumpsuit that says Tokyo Toilet, because that's the name of the project, Tokyo Toilet Project, these navy jumpsuits. And I just thought, there must be something here, because I want to use those toilets.
Oh, right. Yeah. I mean, you know the ones that are like clear glass and then they solidify when you close the door? There's a toilet like that in London that I've been to in like a little club.
Yeah, I have too. I don't like that. That one I'm going to avoid. It's too unnerving.
Are you worried you're worried that the power will stop and it'll disappear? When, of course, we all know that the way it works is when there's no power, it's solid. And you need the power to make it see through.
I love the way you say, of course, we all know that. Like, this is common knowledge that everyone is privy to, this element of this toilet.
Does your brain not, do you not think, right, they're not going to design a toilet where if the power goes, it'll become see?
I haven't given a lot of thought, is all I'm
clearly, and you need to give those toilets much more thought.
After watching this film, I think I've never thought so much about toilets, honestly. But
do you clean yours? Because I tell you what, watching this thing, fucking hell, I don't know.
It was inspiring. I love cleaning toilets and I love doing my laundry. So I really did connect with Hirayama so much. It just felt like an anti-capitalist love note. Have you ever seen those posts on Instagram that say anti-capitalist love notes?
No.
It's just like a little post that says that, essentially, and then words that allude to that kind of thing. And I feel like this film is literally the film version of these sorts of messages, because, you know, he doesn't want more than what he has. There isn't this need for more and more and more. And what I thought was interesting was Wim Wenders in an interview talked about how during the pandemic, he was constantly thinking about what this would mean for our future. How will it all change because of this time? And he was, I think, quite disheartened to see that rather than us all paring back and wanting less, it seemed to have gone in the other direction. Like, if anything, we've become more excessive, you know? And so in making this film, he wanted to create a character who does want less and is very happy with simplicity. And I thought what's really struck me as the first watching it a second time was that this is a man who has a really creative soul. He loves his music. You know, a big part of the film is him having cassettes and him really enjoying the music that I assume he kind of grew up with. But he also, he has a camera and he looks up at the sky and appreciates sun dappling on the side of a toilet, or the blossom and nature and the seasons changing. And he takes a photo every day. And he reads, you know, he's such a cultural, creative, artistic person, but in such a simple way. There's no ego. He's like a monk, but even better, because he's not got a superiority complex, you know? He's just about appreciating the beauty of life, the beauty of what humans can create, the beauty of what nature can create, and relishing that. And it just made me really appreciate all those things and make me want to appreciate all those things in a less consumerist way, basically. That's what this film does through just showing him every day going about his routine.
He's like this still center that all the other characters orbit around, especially his much younger co-worker. And just to see his life, I definitely appreciate the stillness and the calmness of our central character's life. Even though to everybody else, his life must seem very dull and boring to him, it's clear he's very satisfied and very happy. And like, oh my God, maybe I got the wrong career path, Lily. You know?
Yeah, I know. That's it. I'm just so endlessly impressed by people finding joy and satisfaction in less, because I think I'm like most people probably. Like, I'm always
stimulate
thinking
my
about
brain
what
with
next,
everything.
What more, you know?
More,
yeah.
More.
Yeah. What else should I be working towards?
I don't know, but whatever it is, it should be more of it.
Yeah, exactly. So the Zone of Interest, I believe, is still in a few cinemas, and Perfect Days, guys, strongly recommend. I mean, yeah, Zone of Interest, you need to like find your moment, but Perfect Days, I honestly think would cheer anyone up. Like it is a meditative movie. It is so moving. I think you've got to be patient with it, but if you give it the time, I think it really like, it rewards that kind of viewing.
I definitely preferred Zone of Interest of the overall film, if I had to recommend two. But then I certainly would also say it's only a film you've got to watch when you're in the right headspace to watch it. So it comes with a caveat. Nothing worth having comes easy, and Zone of Interest is a challenging film. You know, I think it's one that's going to be stand the test of time, going to be a landmark film for a lot of reasons, I think.
All right, so shall we finish up with a trip to the film pharmacy?
Yes, please.
Okay, so we had an entry that goes something like this. Hi, Lily and James, exclamation point. Longtime groovy mover here, coming to you in despair and desperation. I'm looking for a juicy, well-made, twisty thriller that seemed to be coming up against a wall of Netflix mediocrity. If I'm truly honest with myself, I don't think I've been thrilled since Parasite. The darker the better, and preferably nothing too time-travelly, before James suggests Tenet.
Ilya, a big fan of the series, so they know me too well.
I did think that. Also, what happened to the medium-budget thriller movie? I feel like they're getting fewer and far between. Keep grooving, your loyal listener.
A very loyal listener. Well, I mean...
Beautifully written letter. I love this one.
Great. And, you know, I mean, we've got two questions here, really, haven't we? Which is what's happened to the medium budget thriller and some movie recommendations. So,
yeah, should we start with the second first? Give us your thoughts.
I think the medium budget everything has died a death. It's not just the thriller. Medium budget, insert any genre here, has just gone. It's either very low budget. Like, I watched a great film last week at the student cinema, the secret cinema at the film school, Shiver Baby. $200,000 American independent feature film. So
I love that movie. It's so
good.
It's
a great movie.
Strong recommendation.
An excellent soundtrack. We listened to it in HD 5.1 surround. It sounded terrific, but a very low-budget movie. That has become what used to be the mid-budget movie now, is that now they're basically sub-$1 million kind of films. And then you've got hugely expensive, 100 million plus. I mean, it's almost like 100 million is low budget for a big budget film, up to and including $350 million. Because studios don't want to take a gamble on something that might cost 50 million, but might not make 100 million back at this box office.
So yeah, you're quite right, listener. And we're sorry about that.
Sorry. But I think there's a gap in the market, though, Lily. A medium budget film is going to look better than a Netflix kind of TV series, 10-part TV series, because you can spend your $50 million on 90 minutes worth of material, so it's going to look much better. So I think if studios can start manufacturing films that are just really well made, I just think the days are over, though. I think the days are over. Even as I'm saying it, I can't believe it. I want it to, though. That's the problem. I just think studios are too dumb.
Oh, well...
It all comes down to a gambling mentality. This is ultimately, when we say, like, what's happened to mid-budget movies, it's the gambling mentality. It's higher risk, but higher reward. So because Hollywood is essentially gambling by producers, they're gambling bigger. And so their potential to win big is higher. But as has happened this last year, Disney, you fucking lost loads of money because you had bomb after bomb.
Well, we'll see. Who knows? I mean... We'll have to see how it goes. But yeah, and also, you know, the Mean Girls musical, that wasn't a massive budget movie and it's done obscenely well. So there is definitely a market for it. You're pulling a face, but it doesn't, it's not about...
I don't want mid-budget franchise or intellectual properties, though. Don't do it to me, Lily. Well, I don't want it. I want mid-budget original movies or like based on an obscure book kind of movies, not a remake of a film.
I mean, me too, babe. And I would love that to happen. Maybe it will happen. Who knows? What can we do? It's difficult.
What
it's
can
very
we do?
Difficult. But let's get on to the recommendations because I feel like, you know, the wailing about the state of cinema is too frequent a soundtrack to these episodes. From both of us, James. So what is your suggestion? Did you find a medium budget thriller out of interest for our listener?
Big ask there, like, you know.
I know, same. I couldn't. I've got low, tiny budget, actually, but go on.
I mean, I would say mine are probably medium budget as well, but I was thinking maybe Chinatown for like a twisty neo-noir kind of thriller plot. But darker the better. I mean, that's darker, but you want even darker? Okay, listener, how about The Vanishing from 1988? Do not watch the remake.
The Dutch film.
Yes.
Yeah, it's
yes,
called
yeah.
Spoorloos in Dutch.
Oh, right. Sorry, I did not know that.
But I haven't managed to watch that movie. I've tried a couple of times, but I couldn't find an online version of it, if I'm brutally honest. Maybe I need to get the DVD.
Secondhand Blu-rays are the play. I'm getting into those these days. Blu-rays are about £3 or £4 off eBay, and they look great. So.
I don't have a Blu-ray machine. I think I said Blue Wave just then. Blu-ray.
£25 off Facebook Marketplace.
Okay, fine. Maybe I'll do that. Why not? So you'd recommend that? Is it very dark? I thought it was more of a horror than a thriller.
A horrific thriller?
Nice.
A horrifying thriller? You know,
that sounds great. Okay, good. I think maybe you've nailed it better than me because I was struggling to think of something that wouldn't be kind of obvious and they've probably already seen. And then I settled on Thoroughbreds, the film from 2018, directed by Corey Finley. It stars a young, not that she's that old, but a young Anya Taylor-Moore and Olivia Cooke as well. And also the late Anton Yelchin. It was actually his last role. He died a couple of weeks after the filming of this movie. It's not like the darkest movie, but it is definitely a dark movie. And it's also very fun to watch. It's like about high school students with a sociopathic streak. I don't want to say any more than that because I don't want to give away the plot. But it was made for just $5 million, which kind of blew my mind. But it looks really expensive. Like, it looks good. It's kind of a bit Heathers-y, if you've seen that movie, but higher gloss. It's like Heathers, but with the shinier contemporary sheen to it. And it's a really smart script, and it is quite dark and you know, dark comedy, some twists and turns. Great for a Saturday night with some popcorn. So that would be my recommendation.
Wow, well, I think quite a good selection there to tuck into there.
All right, well, thank you guys for listening to another episode of Groovy Movies. Thanks for staying with us as we've moved to this fortnightly cadence.
It's definitely working for us, so thank you for sticking with us. We really appreciate it. And if you could find your way to leaving us a five-star review or a like or subscribing, please do. We appreciate it. It gets us out to a bigger audience. Thank you.
So we will see you in 2 weeks' time. Bye.
Bye.
Follow us on Instagram at groovymoviespod or email us groovymoviespod@gmail.com.
Groovy Movies was produced and edited by Lily Austin.
Music and sound by James Brailsford.
Our logo was designed by Abby Jo Sheldon.
For references and more information about the films discussed, check out the show notes.